You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. I'm John Cohan. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. Our guest tonight is Ann Dowsett Johnston, journalist and author of the new book Drink, The Intimate Relationship Between Women and Alcohol. By conservative estimates, excessive drinking is responsible for roughly 23,000 deaths of American girls and women each year. Almost 14 million American girls and women, many still in high school, binge drink roughly three times each month, typically consuming six drinks at a time. Drunkorexia is a spiraling problem on campuses, with 16% of college students, primarily female, admitting they have restricted calories in order to consume more alcohol. Among girls in high school, 45% of those first-year students reported binge drinking, and 62% in their senior year reported binge drinking. Alcoholism is a more serious risk for early mortality than smoking, and more than twice as deadly for women than for men, which is mind-blowing to me. Welcome, Ann, to Right Turn Radio. How are you today?
I'm really well, thank you.
Thanks for being here. I'd like to know why you wrote this book.
A lot of people have asked me that question, and there were moments when I was writing it that I asked myself. I grew up with an alcoholic mother who was cross-addicted to Valium and cocktails. She's the classic 1960s, 1970s poster girl for alcoholism, and I was determined never to be in the same place. And then in my 50s, I found myself exactly there. I've been interested in the issue of addiction my whole life, and I felt compelled to tell this story, to share this story, because I think an increasing number of women are facing issues of risky drinking.
So give us an explanation of what you think the women's relationship with alcohol, how it's different from a man's relationship with alcohol.
Yeah, classically, women have a more intimate relationship with alcohol, and by that I mean they treat alcohol as a lover. They are prone to drinking to alone, drinking, isolating, and drinking to medicate feelings of depression, feelings of anxiety, feelings of loneliness. Typically, a man, when he's drinking more than he should, is ending up, say, at a sports bar. He may have a new set of friends, but he's being very social.
Right.
Very, very social and out there. So it's a very different portrait. I was definitely your isolating drinker, the person who drank what everybody else drank until I went home and then opened a bottle of wine.
So you had the social drinking, which seemed normal in context, and then you would go home, and that's when the kind of intimate relationship began.
Right. And I think that, if you're turning to alcohol to numb, which I was, in my case, depression, and if you're turning to alcohol for those reasons to self-medicate, which is very common, you have to really ask yourself about your relationship with this substance. I'm not in any sense trying to be a killjoy or a prohibitionist at all. I think drinking obviously is fine if you don't have a problem with it. But for those of us who do, I think you really have to ask yourself some tough questions, and you certainly have to know what low-risk drinking means, because there are health risks that we don't talk about in our society.
Well, that stat I read early on about 45% of girls in their first year of high school reported binge drinking was a little shocking to me. And it seems like maybe those numbers are on the rise. What's going on in our society where this is becoming a bigger problem among young women?
Well, I think that there's certainly a sense of entitlement. Young women are, outpacing men in the post-secondary world. They're going toe-to-toe in the workplace, and there's a sense that they can drink if they feel like it. There's a sense, I think, also of responding to a really feminized drinking culture. So you see wines with names like Cupcake and Mummy Juice and Girls Night Out Wine and names I won't say on your radio show.
Thank you.
And they are being marketed to from the very beginning in the high school years with things called Alka-Pop. So if you think of Smirnoff, it's Alka-Pop, and so does Bacardi, and there's Mike's Hard Lemonade, and these are sweet vodka or rum-infused drinks that are starter drinks, cocktails with training wheels to
right.
steer young women towards hard spirits. So if you hit a campus, you're likely to find a young man is playing a drinking game, drinking beer, but his girlfriend will be drinking shots, tequila or vodka, and she likely is two-thirds the size and hasn't eaten. So this is not a pretty picture. This is a very different situation than when I went to university.
So you mentioned, you know, haven't eaten, and you talk about drunk orexia in the book. Can you talk a little more about that? Tell our audience what that is.
Right. There really is, as we all know, a real proclivity to be concerned with body image, body weight, and we're seeing on the rise drunkorexia, which is a mixture of eating disorders, be it anorexia or bulimia, and drinking too much, saving all your calories for alcohol. And as you said in a study that was done in the United States last year, 16% of those, primarily women, interviewed said that they indeed practice drunkorexia, which is to limit your calories and be able to drink more. Very dangerous if you're anorexic.
I'm just wondering, is this just a problem in our culture, or is there stuff worldwide with these trends?
It's worldwide, and what's fascinating and sad is that the richer the country, the more narrow the gap between female and male consumption. And why that's dangerous is exactly for the reason that you mentioned in the intro, which is that it's a much more dangerous substance for us than for men. For, you know, democratically we're equal, but metabolically and hormonally we're not. And we respond to alcohol very differently. And therefore, I'm just trying to open up a dialogue and an education about issues such as 15% of breast cancer cases are related to alcohol,
wow.
cognitive impairment, liver damage, all happened earlier in women, just about everything. And you have countries like the UK where you're seeing almost parity with women and men in drinking, and young women in their early 20s presenting with end-stage liver disease, classically an old man's disease.
Yeah.
Very, very alarming.
Now, so we have the developed world, and then we have the developing world, but you talk in your book, and you use part of your story as talking about women in high-status occupations working in male-dominated environments. This is, you know, the changing face of the upper echelon of employment nowadays, where women have achieved parity or some semblance of parity with men, and they have an increased risk of alcohol use disorders. Why is that?
I think it's a sense of entitlement for sure, a sense that, you know, I'm working like a man, I should be able to. I also argue in the book, and I believe that it's become the modern woman's steroid, enabling her to do the heavy lifting involved
right.
in a complex world, in the sense that, you know, I came home and would chop vegetables after a very, very hard day at work, chop vegetables, make an evening meal, and get ready for what was a second shift of work, and often going back to work at home. And I think that it's a decompression tool, and most women would nod their heads. You know, you come home from the office, you pour yourself a glass of wine, maybe you have another with your meal. And for years, that was my pattern, and it was innocuous. And then it wasn't innocuous in my 50s when I hit some other things that I was medicating with alcohol. But that's, I think, a very common pattern, and one that most people relate to.
You know, what's interesting to me is that over time, again, with these shifts in the way the women's role in society, we've also seen there used to be a huge kind of view of a woman who drank too much, and they would put her in a certain category. And I know, just, you know, anecdotally that's changing now. How is that affecting the way women perceive drinking and the amount that they drink, or is it affecting that?
I think women really are very fond of their drinking. They're very fond of their book clubs where, you know, drinking wine is common. It's really treated as a food group, and I think that we are very it's our favorite drug. I mean, there's absolutely no question in our society that we know the downsides of trans fats and tanning beds, but we don't really know the downsides of this. And certainly we don't know that in the United States it's seven drinks a week is the healthy limit for a female. And I think that it just isn't discussed enough, and I think is very troubling. You know, there was a time when we were definitely the target of heavy tobacco advertising. And I'm not saying that alcohol is the new tobacco, but I am saying that the alcohol industry is behaving as the tobacco industry did before, pitching very heavily at women. It's like Virginia Slims. And I think that we have to be a little better educated than we are.
So you talk a little about your own story, and I'm wondering how the women who have read this book have responded to reading it, and what your experience is when they've spoken to you.
I've had an enormous amount of email, people who say over and over again, I've never done this before, but I read your book, and it had a huge impact on me, either because of someone in their family who has had a drinking problem, or more commonly because they believe they're drinking too much.
As you've written the book and it's gotten out there, they've come and told you some of their stories. What do you tell these women, you know, especially the ones, I'm sure a few of them at least, are still drinking? What do you tell them?
I tell them most commonly people are saying that they have quit drinking or are considering quitting drinking. Or there's someone, say, writing me in saying, I have a family member with a problem. And I say, don't give up. On all fronts, don't give up. I wear a bracelet that says never, never, never give up. And yeah. I call it my sobriety bracelet. It's not for the faint of heart to give up a substance that you are addicted to or you're very fond of.
Yeah.
And the heavy lifting is worth it. The world on the other side is a valuable and good one, but it takes a lot of gumption to give up alcohol. And especially in our culture, heavy drinking is extremely normalized, and it's a devilishly difficult problem, because your addiction will tell you that you can drink, and you're just making a mountain out of a molehill. So it's a complex thing to do.
So you've had your own struggles with alcohol, and I understand you've been in recovery for a little while. Can you talk a little about your story of how it got to the point where you thought it might be a problem, and what that turning point was for you?
Yes, the turning point for me came when I was in my 50s, my early 50s, and I had a very tough job, and I was living in a new city and was very lonely and suffered from depression, and I found myself drinking more than I should. And at that point, a cousin was killed by a drunk driver. I remember waking up on a Sunday and thinking, hearing this news and thinking, what else do I need to lose to alcohol? I lost my childhood. I've lost my cousin, and I'm losing my own consciousness. And I tried to give up drinking on my own and found that I couldn't. And that was the most surprising thing. That's how I really learned about addiction, that it would fight back. So I ended up going to rehab, and this is all 5 years ago. I went to rehab, and it was a great experience, but coming back to real life, when you go to rehab, it's easy to give up your substance. Real life is more challenging.
Sure.
So it took me a while. It took me 6 months to get it, and once I got it, I have held on to it quite fiercely, because life in sobriety is really very precious, and very precious, and there's a lot to. As I said to somebody else this morning, I would have a lot to lose now. I've regained relationships and regained some really precious things in my life, not the least of which is myself and my life. And so I hang on to it very fiercely now, but it was quite a journey. quite a journey, and it does take gumption, as I said.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. I wonder if you see any barriers for women seeking treatment as opposed to men.
Yeah, I think it's way more challenging for women, and I think a lot of people would acknowledge that very openly. Typically, a woman is very supportive of their husband going and getting help. Women typically do not feel comfortable leaving their families, do not think they can, don't think they can take the time out from family life to change their lives to go into treatment. And then there's the issue of children. There are very few programs that actually accommodate mothers that have children between the ages of 0 and 6. And we, unfortunately, have seen with cutbacks in recent years the decline of such programs, which are so pivotal because they not only help women put their lives back together and families put their lives back together, but they offer women often parenting, help with parenting skills, help with all sorts of challenges that come with new recovery and being a mother.
Right.
So it's something that we have to think about as a culture. We have to certainly think about children's programs. This is a family disease, and it affects children enormously and in some ways that are indelible. So it's really important that we address those around the person who has a substance problem as well as the person themselves.
So you're talking about like a societal change toward the way we view not just addiction, but women in addiction.
Right, and I think that, you know, there's been a lot of focus recently on recovery. I think that we have tended to destigmatize mental health in recent years, which is terrific.
Yep.
And I think that we need to do the same thing with addiction and start focusing on the millions of us who are in recovery and doing well in recovery. I think we tend to think of addiction as a revolving door. People, you know, get a little sobriety, stumble, slip, and fall back in, and we have a very jaundiced view of what recovery looks like. Then, in fact, many, many of us are hidden and lead very constructive lives in recovery, and I'm working very hard on something called Faces and Voices of Recovery, which has been around for many years in the United States.
Yes.
To develop a better profile for the recovery community.
Is there a difference between how men recover and how women recover from addiction?
You know, I don't think it's profoundly different. I think that there's certainly been a focus on, and I think this is key for both men and women, trauma-informed care, making sure that people, there used to be a notion that people had to be sober for a couple of years before you dealt with underlying causes, and now people are much more accepting of the fact that you have to deal with underlying realities concurrently, and I think that's true for men and women.
Yeah, the thought now is, and we're going to be talking with Judy Crane from The Refuge later on this show, but the thought now is that is to deal. To integrate the treatment with trauma and addiction or co-occurring things to really have the most success. And I know women often, by and large, come into treatment with a larger amount of trauma than men do.
That's right.
And that's a lot of what drives women towards substance use. Your own story, you talked about your mother being kind of a classic 60s, 70s alcoholic and with a pill addiction as well. So here you have this genetic predisposition, it sounds like.
Yes.
To addiction.
Absolutely.
But you're at this incredibly well thought of job at McGill University. Society's view of it is here's this very powerful woman who's really conquered it all and who is gone into this kind of male dominated, you know, field and really done wonderful things. And it must be a great burden to kind of project that image to the world and then know that you have this other thing, this disease that's taking you down quietly.
Yeah, very well put. And I think that what we really, you come to feel so deeply when you're an addict is that it is a spiritual disease as well as a physical disease. You know, my soul was really in despair, and it's extraordinarily challenging to think that you can change your life and you make a deal with the devil, and in fact, you can't change it. So it really took me to my knees, this thing, and it was extremely, extremely difficult to decide to write this book, because once it was written, I knew there was no taking it back. But actually, it's been extremely liberating in the sense that we're only as sick as our secrets. I do believe that, and I do believe we all have public lives and personal lives, but we also have secret lives, and it's been very cathartic to come to terms with all of that's in my book.
If there's young women listening today, and they're not in excessive drinking, or they're not considered alcoholic at this point, but they're wondering how they can kind of guard themselves against it, and it must be really difficult in our society today to do that for girls and young women. What's your advice to them?
My advice is to educate yourself on this substance as well as you'd educate yourself on calories and trans fats. Think of it that way, and count your drinks per week. Make sure you're within safe drinking guidelines. And if you're drinking for the wrong reason, if you're going through a tough patch, if you're going through, you know, something hard at work or at home, and you begin to drink more, be alert to see if you're drinking to numb versus drinking to just simply enjoy yourself. There's a real difference in the drinking pattern, and everyone knows when they're doing so. So I think self-awareness is huge, and I think if you are drinking too much, I think often in recovery we focus on self-care, and my advice is to focus on self-care earlier. If you're coming home and drinking too much after a really hard job, a day at the office, think about what you could be doing, scaling back, changing your patterns, because it really is a very effective and very scary decompression tool.
Is there any analog as to changing the way that the marketing is done that we've found through tobacco and cigarette education in this country and in Canada?
There's some effort to put some standard labeling on alcohol bottles, which would educate people on calories and the amount of number of servings per bottle. I think that, you know, the dialogue is interesting in the sense that I think people can count the number of drinks in a bottle. I think the larger question is, are they going to begin to absorb the information around the breast cancer connection, we all know about liver disease and we know about drinking and driving, but this generation that's coming through university now doesn't drink and drive, generally speaking, but they pre-drink. They pre-drink at home because it's expensive to drink at a bar, so they arrive at the bar having had, you know, shots, et cetera, and I think the question is, are we going to shift our attitude in our culture around alcohol, period? Are we going to see it as risky in the way that it actually is, or are we preferring to plug our ears? And I think the truth is our values are very fuzzy around alcohol, and we prefer to plug our ears.
And thank you so much for taking time out to speak with Right Turn Radio. We really appreciate the work you're doing. We hope to continue to see your work on this subject in the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.